supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Ohio State University found that a stable family situation after divorce doesn't erase the negative effects of divorce, but these children did fare much better than those in an unstable
family.
Support for
Voices in the Family is made possible.
In an unstable family, whether married or divorced. So that brings up the question of how parents who are divorcing can best help their children. It is the quality of the divorce and post-divorce that has the great impact on a child's welfare. Alisa Walters recently spoke to 24-year-old Holly, whose parents were divorced when she was 11.
What was your relationship like with your parents after they divorced?
Initially, it wasn't very good. I obviously was not seeing my father as much just because I was living with my mother, and that really put a strain on our relationship, and it was really difficult initially. I was definitely angry for a while at both of them for reasons I couldn't really articulate today, just, you know, general angst about the whole situation. And even though I was living with my mom, my relationship with her was a bit strained at the time.
What was their relationship like?
At the beginning, their relationship was not so good. There was still some fighting, and actually probably more fighting after the divorce that I saw anyway than before the divorce. I don't know why, but there just seemed to be a lot more fighting and trying to work things out, and they were not doing it in a way that was really beneficial, I felt, to compromise.
That was Alisa Walters talking with Holly, whose parents divorced when she was 11. We're joined now to discuss this issue of divorce, its impact on children, and how to mitigate that impact. So we're joined by Dr. Constance Ahrens and Michelle Southworth. Dr. Ahrens is a professor emerita at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. She's author of The Good Divorce, We're Still Family, and the co-author of Divorced Families. Connie, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good to be here.
Michelle Southworth is a divorce mediator here in Philadelphia. She's a family therapist affiliated with the Council for Relationships. She's also in private practice. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about the impact of divorce on children throughout the life cycle. I have a sneaking suspicion we're going to get a lot of calls, so if you do want to call, please call early in the show. Connie, let's start with you. You made a statement when we spoke with you before the show that brushes up against heresy for a mental health professional. You said divorce is not necessarily bad for children, and a post-divorce family could be even better for a child.
Mm-hmm.
So,
First of all, the thing that we know from all the research is that interparental conflict, whether parents are married or divorced, is bad for kids. And so that if the marriage is a destructive marriage, in terms of if the parents are in high conflict with each other, or if they show no love to each other and it's a cold kind of home, oftentimes children do far better when their parents divorce, and especially if their parents go on to have a life that is, you know, happier and healthier for the kids. So it's better to divorce if the home life, and especially if it is high conflict, you know, is damaging to the children.
Specifically, high conflict divorces. You're not talking about now necessarily where one person might be unhappy with the other or feel unfulfilled, but there's no fighting. That kind of thing.
You're talking I'm specifically focusing here on high-conflict divorces, but it's important to remember that in this individualistic society, people divorce for a variety of reasons. And if somebody is very unhappy with their marriage, let me, an example would be, you know, the mother, and so she gets very depressed. Well, having a very depressed mother is not particularly healthy for children. or the father stays away from home a lot just because he doesn't want to have to deal with things at home. Some of those dads did much better after the divorce, were more active with their kids. So if we don't, you know, moralistically can't say, you know, don't divorce, but certainly in high-conflict families, there the children can do better if the post-divorce family situation improves.
All right, so we're talking, though, about quality of divorce and its impact on children, and so we know high-conflict families are harmful for children, not to mention parents, of course, mm-hmm. but don't high-conflict marriages almost de facto result in high-conflict divorces?
You know, that is so fascinating, Ben, and we don't have any research that shows us that, you know, definitively, but I have been able to see, both in my practice and in some of the couples in the research, depending on what the conflict is about, but oftentimes high-conflict couples can be much lower conflict after divorce, because if the issues are embedded in the marriage and the dailiness of having to be there with each other, oftentimes they can get some relief from this. So it doesn't always figure. I've seen some of the marriages, people divorce where the marriage on the outside, you know, it's not high conflict, it looks pretty good, people say, gosh, they're holding hands, why are they ending up in divorce court? And they have very high conflict divorces because they've repressed what they're so angry
about. Could you give us an example of a high conflict marriage that went well in divorce? I'm having trouble visualizing that.
Yes. A couple who, you know, everything that the other one did, you know, got them angry. The anger went back and forth. The conflict kept rising. There was a lot of issues about alcohol in the family and so on. And this is a couple that were screaming at each other, you know, whenever they were in each other's presence. When they went through the initial parts of the divorce and they went through the legalities of it, the anger was still present, but some of the issues no longer had to be dealt with. The woman was able to say, you know, I don't have to deal with this day to day. I don't have to wake up in the morning and look at him and be reminded. Hmm. And they were able to let go of some of that anger.
Let's talk a little bit about the process, and we'll take that to you, Michelle. First, help us understand the concept of mediation. Traditional divorces are adversarial. He goes to his lawyer, she goes to hers, and the lawyers advocate and fight with one another. Psychotherapy is just the opposite. It's about coming together. It's about healing wounds. Mediation is neither one of those.
Mediation is set up to do a couple of things. I mean, two parts of the adversarial divorce give families probably the biggest problems. One is that it's adversarial, and the other is that people feel out of control. And so mediation is designed to really help with both of those aspects. The people who are divorcing are the people who are in control of the process. They consult with lawyers, they use the mediator to kind of create a structure for them, but they are the ones who are in charge of actually making the decisions. So rather than a judge or rather than what lawyers can compromise on, they come to a decision together. So that's one way that it's different. The other way that it's different is that when you start with a mediator rather than when you start with separate lawyers, you are acknowledging the fact that even though you're divorcing, you have some very important interests in common. And the interests that you have in common are, most parents feel very strongly that they want to do the least amount of harm to their children possible. And that's a priority with almost every family I work with. They may not be successful, but almost every parent sees that as very important. They want to get it over with quickly. They don't want to spend their entire fortune doing it. Those are all important common goals that they have. Sometimes people really have a commitment to treating each other decently. Not always, unfortunately, but sometimes that's also a common goal. So mediation lets them say, we're going to make those goals the priority. We each have individual goals, too. You know, we both want to survive financially. We both want to be able to go on to some kind of a decent life. But we'll work that in. The priority will be our common goals.
So I would imagine the aforementioned high-conflict couples that Connie referred to would be less likely to show up at your door in the first place.
They would be less likely, and even if they did show up, I have a screening process that would probably screen them out.
Hmm. Let's go to a short break, and then I want to come back and hear more about mediation and what can be done for the children, who is most likely to do better for the children and how. We're talking about post-divorce, how to divorce in a way that minimizes its impact on children. My guests are Dr. Connie Ahrens and Michelle Southworth. Ahrens is a professor emeritus from UCLA. She's written several books, including The Good Divorce and We're Still Family. Michelle Southworth is a divorce mediator here in Philadelphia, and she's affiliated with the Council for Relationships. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Cardiovascular Center at the Chester County Hospital supports WHYY. Just as we're a partner in cardiac surgery with Cleveland Clinic, we want our patients to be partners in care with us. To help you get the facts you need, our website now features important information about quality of care, patient satisfaction, and more. Located in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and online at 866drheart.com, the Cardiovascular Center is part of the health network of the Chester County Hospital, beyond good care.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan about his controversial new memoir and his view of Washington's culture of deception. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the impact of divorce on children. More important, what can be done to mitigate the impact of divorce on children? My guests are Dr. Connie Ahrens, professor emerita from the University of California in Los Angeles, has written The Good Divorce, We're Still Family, co-authored Divorced Families. I'm also here in the studio with Michelle Southworth. She's a divorce mediator and a family therapist affiliated with the Council for Relationships in private practice. Connie, Judy Wallerstein asserts that divorce's damage may not appear for a decade or more.
Mm-hmm.
What's your reaction to this?
Well, first of all, I've written about it in quite detail, but I'll give you just the summary of it. Is that, first of all, the sample was a problem in that it wasn't a healthy sample. Wasn't people who came into her sample had to volunteer, and they had to volunteer for counseling as well as them being part in the research. But in addition, it was a very small group of girls that she based these data on. So it scared a lot of people. It doesn't appear to be so. It's the issue that boys act out oftentimes around the time of the divorce, and girls. And this is very generalized, and girls are more likely to get depressed, and it was her theory that the depression, you know, shows up in, 10 years later, often in young adulthood or late adolescence. But it's not a valid finding. It's not been supported by any other piece of research, and it's not based on very many.
So speaking of research, I want to talk about some of the research you've done for mm-hmm. for both of your books. You began interviewing post-divorce families in the 1980s. So you interviewed them several times over the next several years.
Yes.
Yes.
So three times, actually. We interviewed them at 1 year after their divorce, and then again at 3 years, and again at 5 years, and we interviewed both parents and any new partners.
Okay. So What did you find out? Did this data conflict with any of our previous assumptions about divorce?
Well, we certainly found out that the range of divorce and that our stereotypes were not always correct, that the ranges of divorces were very different. You know, they could go across the whole continuum. There were almost 100 families that we interviewed. And we did find that, you know, there were just, some were very good and people were very friendly afterwards, and some were just absolutely awful and hostile. We found out that people make changes over the 5 years that we interviewed them, that some got better, some stayed the same, and some got worse.
And what's the difference?
What's the difference in the numbers, or what's the difference
no.
in how they did it?
Yeah, we're B. What's the
B.
difference in how they did it?
Well, I think one of the things that we found is when there was nobody in the family that was seriously disturbed and had any real deep-seated psychological problems, that they were more likely to get better. If there was maturity and they could work together, then they were more likely to improve their relationship as the anger diminished over time. So that over a five-year period, we could see that. One of the interesting things, Dan, that we did find was with fathers. We found that the fathers that were more involved at 1 year post-divorce tended to stay involved and were more involved at 5 years post-divorce. The fathers that were less involved, and these were mostly mother custody families back in those years. We didn't have joint custody when these people
right.
divorced. The fathers that were not involved tended to be the ones who dropped out more at 5 years. And also we found that the fathers were very angry at their limited accessibility to their children.
So that brings us back to the relationship post-divorce, whether fathers are too angry to stay involved or be willing to stay involved, and whether mothers are too angry to invite the fathers to be involved.
Right. So, and it does take both of them, you know, and it does take that relationship. We found that the better the relationship between the parents, the more likely that dad was to stay involved. And as you know, I continued this research and then interviewed 173 of their children at 20 years post-divorce. So
and
we got it from the adult children's point of view about their dads as well.
And
we found some very, I think, you know, good findings and important findings for both dads and moms to know about, is that about half of the kids, their relationships with their dads got better. And that, you know, for us 20 years later was quite interesting to see and definitely counter to the stereotype that many of these dads stayed very involved in their children's lives. And it didn't matter. It wasn't related to the dad who saw his kid 3 times a week or the dad who saw his kid once a month. It was related to how invested in their lives he was. You know, if he didn't see them, did he know that they played hockey that day? Did he call and ask how they did? Did he always remember, you know, what they were doing
in
their
lives? Yeah, you know, kind of my experience in working with these dads is that they love their children pretty consistently, except they don't quite know how.
Yes. Well, you know, there is some new early intervention research, I think, that's very promising, and that is teaching dads how to be better parents. They don't often know. And this early intervention research is not only with divorced dads, but it's with dads and generally more low-income fathers. And they're definitely finding that this is very helpful to get in there early and work with dads. And they also found that as their dads learned how to parent better, they also had better relationships with the mothers of the children.
Yeah, and probably better relationships with themselves, too.
I think you're right, Dan.
Let me turn to you, Michelle, before we go to the phones. Tell us about the process of mediation. How do parents work out their relationships with their kids and with each other? You know, Connie talked about anger as being an issue, and once they get through their anger, well, traditional therapy works on anger. Mediation, I would think, doesn't work on anger per se.
Well, mediation doesn't specifically target anger as part of the agenda. I mean, the agenda in mediation is a pretty nuts and bolts, practical, get your financial information together, get some input from lawyers, try and figure out how you're going to structure your life. But there is an important emotional process that's at work as you're doing that. I mean, it looks very practical, but if you think about what people are really doing in that situation, they are sitting down together and taking apart what they built together. And they're doing it as well as they can. In mediation, they're doing it as kindly as they can. They're really trying to respect their past so that they can build a decent future out of it. So that kind of a process really allows them to possibly mourn the end of their own marriage. There is a certain, it's not part of the agenda in mediation, but it's certainly part of what happens. They get to express the things that they're angry about in a setting where they're definitely going to be heard, and if there's a response required, I'll definitely encourage that to happen. So they have a way of processing some of the things that are happening as they're ending their marital relationship, but sort of restructuring their parenting relationship, that there really isn't any other way for people to do, really. There are some people who go through divorce counseling and do some of that work, but not very many, and I don't know how recognized that is as an alternative. But a lot of people do go through mediation, and the process itself of bringing these things to a close works through some of the anger, some of the sadness, some of the fear, and brings them out the other side.
Well, it sounds like what you're working with are many of the issues that cause the anger. I'll speak for myself, but I'm also bet I'm speaking for 90% of everybody who's been divorced, that the underpinnings of my anger was feeling out of control, feeling scared and not knowing what was going to happen. And anger is probably a better emotion to feel than all of those other tender, vulnerable ones. And what you're doing, it sounds like, is setting a structure where both people feel less out of control and feel safer.
Exactly. That's the purpose of the structure, is to break it down into little manageable steps so that people see where they are, they see what the steps are to get where they're going, and they become less overwhelmed.
We're talking about post-divorce, how to divorce in ways that don't harm the children as much. My guests are Connie Ahrens, who's written The Good Divorce and We're Still Family. I'm also with Michelle Southworth. She's a divorce mediator with the Council for Relationships. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Chris on the line.
Chris, hi. Basically, I would like to go through mediation. The problem that I have, and you kind of touched on it, was that my wife's had an affair, and she says the affair's over, but I assume in mediation, you have to trust your spouse coming to agreement on various issues.
Custody,
et cetera.
Chris, I think I've got the gist of it. I'm going to ask you to take your answer off the air because we got such a bad connection.
Sure.
So I guess I'm going to ask both of you to weigh in on this. There's an issue of trust. I'll start with you, Michelle. His wife had an affair. At one level, is that relevant? And at another, how can you go forward without trust?
Right. Well, relevance has many layers to it. Legally, it's of limited relevance.
Right, that's
emotionally,
why.
It's of enormous relevance.
Right.
And so I guess part of what I would say is that until some of the devastation and the rage and all the rest of the things that people feel in that situation have been worked through to some extent, it's probably going to be too early to mediate because everything's going to come back to those issues.
Go on.
However, there's another aspect to it, which is the trust that you have with someone to not betray you in that way is not necessarily the same trust that you need to have to make sure that if they tell you they're going to write you a check for $500, that they'll actually do it. So it may be that the trust is lost in one area, but there is still a good enough relationship with enough trust around the financial issues that the mediation can proceed once some of these intense emotions have been processed.
Connie, let's see if we can make that question even more broad. Here we have, and I'm sure this is the case with probably most divorces, that trust is gone or certainly impaired. So how do we go forward trusting one another's integrity in this process.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with Michelle. It often helps if people have had some counseling prior to the divorce, which many people do, where they deal with the trust. I also think there's another process in addition to mediation called collaborative divorce that I'm quite involved with here. And collaborative divorce, I think, helps in that quite a bit, in that collaborative divorce is a team that works together. So there are two lawyers, and there's a financial specialist, and there's a child specialist who's a mental health professional, and then there's a coach for each of the partners. And we found that when there has been an affair, and that, you know, comes up frequently, that it helps that each has their private coach to sort of work through those issues and to be able to help the people, you know, to look beyond the affair and trust, and as Michelle says, to look at, you know, in what areas do they trust each other.
So I am sure I'm not going to be the first person to say this, but collaborative divorce sounds fabulous, and it sounds very expensive and impractical.
It is expensive up front. The research, though, on it so far, and it's fairly new, is showing that it's not certainly more expensive than an adversarial process. It may be more expensive than a mediation process. But even in mediation, frequently people each have their own lawyers as well. But it's not more expensive at all than, you know, when you have an adversarial process that goes on and on and on. But in an adversarial process, you don't really know what it's going to cost you pretty much up front. In collaborative, you have a pretty good idea of what it's going to cost you.
traditional divorce, I want to talk about custody here and what happens to the children and what the parents do. Traditional custody arrangements, a child lives with one parent, typically a mother, and the other parent visiting. This model's been around, I guess, since divorce has been around, and probably came from psychoanalytic theory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is it relevant? Is this the best arrangement for children?
Well, a couple of things. One is, you're right, it came from psychoanalytic theory, where the stability of the child was one household, and that the best interest of the child was to be, especially during the early years, was to be with mother. I think, at least in the western part of the United States, and I think so, it's growing more in the eastern part too, the traditional custody arrangement now is joint legal custody. And it doesn't mean that that's shared physically. And still mothers have children, you know, the predominant amount of time. I think for many children, the best arrangement that they can have is when parents can be sufficiently cooperative to have a shared custody arrangement where children do go back and forth between parents and have the ability to see both of their parents frequently. I mean, that's what kids want. They don't want to lose a significant relationship with a parent.
The argument is that it's not healthy for a child to live out of two homes, well, not live out of two homes, but they need one home base, they need a primary residence. It's not healthy for a child to go to school from two different homes. Is that valid, or is that just mental health anxiety?
That, you know, it's not valid in terms of the little bit of research that's come through on that. And it's not so much valid. I mean, I work with a lot of parents who are willing to live quite close to each other, who make the transitions for the children quite easily, and children adapt to them. This is what they're used to.
Right.
I mean, and so both homes are home to them. Oftentimes the dog goes back and forth, you know, and the children are, it's an open relationship where children can call parents frequently. There are some people who do it to an extreme of, you know, living in the same apartment building, or living in a duplex together, or, you know, those are the extreme cases. But parents who want to do shared custody really need to live within fairly close proximity. They need to have a fairly cooperative relationship with each other. They don't have to be good friends, but they certainly have to communicate well and frequently about the children.
That's an interesting approach. Just as you say that, I was wondering if the dog was okay going back and forth. But they adapted. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bill on the line. Bill?
Hi.
What can
Hi,
we...
how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, of course.
What do you do? I've been divorced now for 9 years, and the thing with the dog, actually, you know, the dog was a was part of our family, but right after the divorce, my ex-wife threatened to get rid of the dog because, you know, I'm not there anymore. So I was forced to, you know, have the dog back and forth for 2 years every week. You know, at which time, you know, that was extremely obtrusive, and, you know, I had to plan where I would live and all that stuff. But ultimately, I couldn't keep it up for more than 2 years. But what do you do when one parent does not want healing in the post-relationship after the marriage and the other one does?
What do you mean? Well, I guess
healing as, you know, we were told we need counseling. You know, for the sake of the child, and although she agreed to it in court, I can't get her to go to any type of counseling. I've been in counseling myself for 9 years, and, you know, which, you know, helps my anger issues, but she does not want to, you know, cultural beliefs and, you know, past emotional trauma due to sexual abuse. So, you know, in the meantime, my son is with her, and, you know, I just, it's hard to watch him become a victim.
How so, Bill?
He has become me in their relationship. He cooks for her. He's 16 now. You know, he cooks for her. He takes care of her. You know, he's been forced into a really, you know, awful type of situation, and it's really hard to watch.
Does he? Clearly, it's hard to watch. Does he say it's awful?
He complains. He complains, but, you know, it's part of his life now. He doesn't say it's awful, but, you know, he displays things that a 16-year-old should not. You know, worried about his mom coming home, or, you know, really, truly, he's you know, he's been put in a situation in which he should not have not been put in.
Connie.
Yeah, that's a difficult situation. And, Bill, as you know, you can't change anybody else, and you don't have any control over the situation, you know, with your wife and son. And it's, and clearly she's not abusive, but, you know, she is clearly relying on him in ways that he shouldn't. I think the thing, the hardest thing to do is that you have to provide the role model. You have to take the high road on this one, because there isn't much you can do about it. And you have to be as close to him as you possibly can. It is a sad thing. One of the things I found in interviewing the children in my research, like if there were three children in a family, oftentimes one child was the child who took care of the less healthy parent. So if there was an alcoholic parent or a depressed parent or something, there was one child who often took care of that parent, and that child, you know, did not fare as well 20 years later as maybe his or her siblings did. But a close relationship with a father can at least help the child through it. There's nothing you can do to change what's going on with his mother.
I would also want to add something else into that, Bill. You said you were in counseling.
Yes.
And I wonder, is your son in counseling with you?
No. I've tried, but she will not allow that to happen.
She won't allow your son to be in counseling?
Right. Or you know, it's pretty expensive. And, you know, she won't also help, you know, with the expense of that.
Well, I wonder about him coming in with you. Here's what I'm thinking, and not about counseling per se. But if you could be a resource for him and make it safe and clear for him to talk about his feelings about his relationship with his mother, without your being judgmental or critical and tolerating your own helplessness, that he would feel less alone in the process when he's over there. One of the things that I would like to see happen for him in the short run, and certainly in the long run, is for him to understand his mother in context, that she might be impaired, that her rigid beliefs are about her own anxiety, and that she is doing the best she can, and that she needs help, and his helping her could be a choice, that he could choose to help her or not to help her. And these are the things that I would like to see him explore in his own therapy, ideally.
Okay. I'll discuss that with my therapist and see how I can work that in.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. Right. Yeah, thanks so much for your call, and I do wish you the best.
All right. Thank you.
So, Michelle, mediation doesn't work out if one spouse is not fully voluntary.
Right. It's a completely voluntary process. I mean, you do have court-ordered counseling at times, but that's a separate thing from mediation.
Right.
Yeah, and the other thing, Dan, on that is that in terms of Bill here and his son, he can't bring his son into counseling depending on the custody arrangement.
Yeah, I was thinking of that when I said it.
Yeah. I mean, that would be ideal. The other important thing would be, what we saw is that for these kids, the most important thing was that if they had some other adult outside the family to talk to.
Right.
Because then it's not disloyal in the same way as talking to Dan.
Yeah, even better. That's a good point. Okay, we're going to have to take a short break. We're going to hear from some other people when we get back from the break, and we'll hear from you. We're talking about divorce, how to make it best for the children, what steps need to be taken, how that can happen, how we can learn to love our children more than we hate our ex. If you've had experience with this or if you are in the middle of it, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, the number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you feel your children are suffering as a result of your divorce, or perhaps if you did when you were a child. 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. Connie Ahrens, professor emerita at UCLA. She's written The Good Divorce, We're Still Family, and she's co-authored Divorced Families. I'm also joined here in the studio by Michelle Southworth. She's a divorce mediator and family therapist with the Council for Relationships. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
You know, laughter is this kind of clumsy, inarticulate way of expressing ourselves, but it's also kind of awesome.
First question, why do we laugh? What is laughter for? On the next Radio Lab, we wonder about the mysteries of laughter, from a baby's first laugh to an outbreak of contagious laughter in Tanzania.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
For news that's concise.
This really was a day when the president wanted to send a signal to
some helpful advice.
You want to ask them, what kind of credentials do you have? What are your qualifications? What services do you offer?
And always something nice.
There are ponies here. 5, 6, 7. And it looks like there's a foal out there.
Join us on NPR's Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about divorce and its impact on children, how to minimize that impact on children. My guests are Michelle Southworth. She's a divorce mediator and family therapist with the Council for Relationships here in Philadelphia. I'm also joined by Dr. Connie Ahrens, Professor Emerita from UCLA. She's written The Good Divorce, We're Still Family, and she's co-authored Divorced Families. Well, Elisa Walters spoke with a young woman named Dana. Dana is now in her late 30s, but her parents divorced when she was 8 years old. Let's listen.
My parents have always put me first. They never argued in front of me. I never felt that presence in the house before the divorce, and I never felt it after. They've always been good friends. They've always come to functions together on my behalf while I was growing up, and even barbecues and Christmas Day and things of that nature that we would spend together as a family, they could converse with each other, they could spend time with each other, and they could enjoy each other's company. There was no animosity and resentment and things of that nature. My mother never spoke badly of my father, and my father never spoke badly of my mother.
Was there ever a time that you realized that your parents' divorce affected you?
I'm 38 years old, and I think I'm actually realizing that now. I feel as if it has definitely affected the relationship choices that I've made in my life. I am currently going through a second divorce. My mother is on her third marriage. My father was her second marriage. And I'm very much following a pattern that I didn't realize really existed until recently, in that I got married young. I had two children. So did my mother. I got divorced. I needed a certain father figure and certain aspects in a man, or at least I thought I did at the time, for my boys when they were young. And my mother married my father for almost the same reasons. And then I came along out of that marriage, and I now have a daughter out of the second marriage who will be experiencing divorce at the age of 8, as I did.
How are you working out details with her father to maintain a civil relationship for the sake of her?
I really try to use my own parents as a model. I never speak badly about my daughter's father, at least not in her presence. and I do not have resentment and animosity toward him. I just realize that we're both good people, we're both good parents, we're just not necessarily good together. And I explained to her that although mommy and daddy don't love each other in a sense of boyfriend and girlfriend, that we love each other because we're her parents, and that she's always first, and that no matter what happens, no one will ever take our love away from her.
Well, Connie, let's talk about what happens to adults. You've been divorced twice.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of how your divorces have affected your children?
Well, I can only tell you that I'm sure that they had some effect on the children. I'm not quite sure what the effect was. They're both adults now, and they have children of their own. And I should say hello to my little granddaughter, Emma, who's out there in Philadelphia, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, you'd really have to ask them. I think it's very hard for a parent to be able to say what the effects are, because we all hope that the effects are minimal. And I also know, and this is important to notice, that the effects were different on each one of them. They weren't the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that in my study as well, is that the effects are quite, you know, different in the children. I wanted to respond to something Dana said, because there is a little bit of research that does show us that there is some intergenerational, if you want to call it, passing on of divorce. As a parent, children who, when children have both parents, when a man and woman get married, if each of their parents are divorced, if both of their parents are divorced, they are more likely to divorce than somebody in the general population would be.
So it would affect choice.
And the reason that we tend to choose somebody maybe like our mother did or whatever is that we tend to, there's a comfort level in whatever we got used to living with. And so the fact that she maybe has made some of the same errors in choice, if you want to call it that, about, it sounds like she chose good parents but maybe not the best person for her as a husband. You know, I think it does take some working that through, counseling helps, you know, growth helps in that. But it sounds like she's doing a great job in her own, you know, divorce with her kids.
Let's see if we can get another couple calls in before we have to close. We'll go with Pat.
Hello. Thank you for speaking with me.
Sure.
Just very briefly, one of the challenges, it took me 10 years to get a divorce. And one of the challenges is that my ex-spouse has a personality disorder, and I think sometimes what's not recognized in divorce is that if you have two very high-functioning parents, even if one has personality issues, the divorce is much, much more difficult and much more detrimental to the children. I see that my son is rather compartmentalized in terms of his emotions and in terms of his experience in dealing with me and dealing with his father, because there's still a high level of animosity, and it's very, very difficult. And I've actually apologized to my son for not doing a better job, but I don't know how I could have done a better job when, you know, faced with the real situation. So I'd like you to comment on that. Sometimes the other partner, it's very difficult sometimes to have control over situations, and even though you try to protect your child.
Well,
so
it's not.
I'll take it off the
it's
line.
It's not difficult sometimes to have control over situations. It's difficult all the time to have control over situations. Well, Connie, let me hear your reaction to what you heard.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. We can't control it. We can't change the other person, and it's painful. It sounds like it's very painful for Pat to see this, you know, going on, and that she has no control over. And the best that she can do is to be the best mother that she can be to her child.
Yeah, part of the direction I want to go in is on the other side of anger, on the other side of her anger. And it doesn't matter if she's entitled to it or not. It doesn't matter whether she's lived with injustice. Of course she has. Of course, of course the anger is going to be there. But on the other side of it, he is the person he is. And he's not going to be the person she wants him to be or that he ought to be. He's the person he is. And the question is, the more difficult question is, okay, now what? Now how am I going to be in a relationship with the person he is, rather than fighting with the person I think he should be? And I think that's the greatest challenge. I think that's the hard work. That probably takes years. And that was my thought with the other gentleman, with his wife, where he felt badly about you know, his 16-year-old son caring for his mother. You know, it's you're fighting against the person you think she should be. And I don't think that's going to happen for most of us. Connie, tell me how your children's relationship is with their father.
Well, their father is deceased. But before he died, I think that they both had a very close relationship with him. And it was interesting, Dan, because we always lived 1,000 miles apart. But he loved his children dearly, and he was very close with them and knowing about their lives, and they spent time in the summer with him and vacations. And they maintained a close relationship with him until his death. And I should note that before he died, he and I walked our older daughter down the aisle together. And I'm sure had he been alive, we would have walked our younger daughter down the aisle together. And I am still in relationship with his widow, and with the two children, the half-siblings of my children, I still in a fairly close relationship with them as well.
Connie, what was his death like for you?
I didn't expect it to be as difficult as it was, to be honest with you. I thought it was, you know, mainly about the children. I went to the funeral at the request of my children and with the certain approval, certainly the approval of his widow and her family. It was hard because I lost my co-parent. Even though we were not close friends, we had learned to be cooperative with each other. And I had lost the one other person in my life who cared about these children as deeply as I did. And so it was more difficult, as much as I thought I was grieving for my children's loss, which was a very difficult loss for them. I also experienced quite a bit of loss.
I had the same thing happen to me, that my ex-wife died, and I was at her funeral. She died too soon after the divorce for us to really begin to heal our relationship, although we were civil with one another. And I was at the funeral, and I experienced it as extraordinarily painful for the same reason. And I visit our grandson, and I miss her every time I visit our grandson, and And I feel some sadness that I didn't know those emotions were there before she died.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that for everyone who's been, who is divorced, that there is a tenderness, there is a tender connection that's there that doesn't go away, but because of our defenses, we don't often know about that tender connection.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. We've been talking about divorce, what's a good divorce, and how to best heal our children. My guests have been Dr. Constance Ahrens and Michelle Southworth. Ahrens is the author of The Good Divorce, We're Still Family, and co-author of Divorced Families. Thanks for your time, Connie.
Thank you very much, Dan, and thanks so much for doing the show.
Michelle Southworth is a divorce mediator and a family therapist affiliated with the Council for Relationships here in Philadelphia. She's also in private practice. I'd just like to mention, thank you, Michelle. I forgot.
Thank you, Dan.
I just want to mention a couple of events. On Friday, June 6th, this coming Friday, I'll be speaking at the Wellness Community of Philadelphia, their 10th annual Celebration of Hope. It's at the Hyatt Penn's Landing in Philadelphia. For more information, it's twcp.org. Also, we've got a free panel discussion on June 12th at 6 p.m. here at WHYY. For more information about that, visit us at whyy.org. You're about to hear a different close for today's show. We also always close the show by saying Mike and Scott is our producer. All change is loss, and all loss is change. After 9 years of producing this show, after 9 years of making me look smart and more organized, more so than I am or probably deserve to be, Mike and Scott is moving on to be the mental health reporter here at WHYY. Because after working with me for 9 years, she's actively searching for some source of mental health. Mikan, when you first came to this show, I loved you. And there was adversity back then. I loved you. I loved our relationship. We felt very protective of one another, and it has lasted for 9 years. You are a dear, special, trusted friend and an amazing producer for this show. I thank you. We all thank you. And I'm speaking for my audience. They all thank you too. Bless you. Bless you. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Mike and Scott is now our executive producer. And crying, by the way. Voices in the Family is now co-produced by Elisa Walters and Gita Simons. Welcome to you guys. Welcome to part of the family. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb.